What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi and Cantor Baruch J. Kohan, discussing his new book, Learning Torah All Over Again. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Our attention has been focused this week on the American presidential election, as well as races for the U.S. Senate and House. There are many lessons from this particular election cycle, but if we have learned anything from the past few years of American politics, it is that believing in pollsters isn't a good idea. 4 years ago, nearly all of them predicted a victory for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. This year, nearly all of them predicted a comfortable victory for Joe Biden over Donald Trump, along with the Democratic takeover of the U.S. Senate. In fact, most of the speculation among predictors in the run-up to this election was over just how large of a Democratic landslide the election would prove to be. Needless to say, that's not how it all played out. In fact, in an election in which a truly tremendous turnout took place, the highest proportional voting in an American election since 1900, 120 years ago, we learned yet again that pollsters and political pundits are less reliable than weathermen, and that their predictions of the future are about as accurate as coin flipping would be. I'm reminded of a prohibition in the Torah I've never truly understood before now. It's in the book of Exodus, in the Torah portion of Mishpatim, and it says, "Machashefa lo tchayeh," which translates to, "Do not allow a witch to live." This has always puzzled me a bit. Witchcraft and wizardry are just hocus-pocus and pose no threat to authentic religious belief. In Jewish tradition, they have no ability to stand up to the very real power of God. So why does Torah mandate this extreme punishment for practitioners of the supposed dark arts? I think it has to do with the way witches were used to try to predict the future in the Hebrew Bible. In a story of King Saul, just before his final battle with the Philistines, he consults the witches of Endor, in both the King James Version and the George Lucas Star Wars movies, and Saul uses these witches of Endor to conjure up the ghost of his mentor, the judge Samuel, so that he might learn the outcome of the next day's battle of Gilboa. The results aren't good. Samuel is ticked off at being pulled up out of death by these witches, and he tells King Saul he will lose his kingdom and his life the next day. That dire prediction comes true. It is no wonder that future Israelite kings don't try that same trick again. By the way, Shakespeare used the biblical witches of Endor as inspiration for his witches in Macbeth. That doesn't end very well either. There are a few other attempts to see the future through the use of prediction and divination in the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, and none of them end up very well. There is one other clear example of divination that is sanctioned in Jewish tradition. It is a somewhat obscure part of the work of the high priests, the Kohanim, in the days of the Tabernacle and the First and Second Temples. In the breastplate that the high priest wore was a place for two stones, called the Urim and the Tumim, which were to be consulted in some way or other by the leaders, generals, or kings before doing some truly dramatic national action, such as going out to war. I don't know just how the Urim and the Tumim worked. No one actually does, but they may have been some kind of predictive devices for the future. Most sources, however, think they were used to determine guilt and innocence in trials, perhaps, and the meaning of Urim and Tumim, the words, perhaps light and perfections, or illumination and truth. would lead you to think that they were intended for judgment rather than prediction. In any case, they don't seem to have had a major role to play in predicting the future in any pragmatic sense. Now, you might wonder just what the many prophets in the Bible are doing that differs from the work of witches. After all, they seem to be engaged in efforts to predict the future, don't they? Yet their words are treated with respect and reverence, and they are certainly not executed. But prophets are not actually trying to predict the future, although that's the stereotype of the biblical prophet. In fact, prophets are trying to get the Israelites to behave better. And by bringing messages from God, they are simply telling them that if they don't change their ways, they will incur severe punishments. It is more parental than predictive. And they use no fancy technology to summon spirits to tell them what will occur in the future. They just poetically tell people to shape up and worship only God, to treat the poor and the immigrant with generosity and kindness, or else they will be horribly destroyed. It's not so much predictive prophecy as motivational morality. The apparent message in the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, is that trying to discern the future by means of fancy technology is not sanctioned by God and will result in disaster. I thought about this a lot as the results came in from the election voting the last few days. Pollsters use all kinds of magical means to supposedly determine the results of elections before they occur, with the most sophisticated technology at their disposal. You know, kind of like witches. They may not call up the ghost of King Saul, but they are undoubtedly trying to summon up images of the future before these events actually occur. And their confident predictions, well outside the margin of error is my favorite term from this year, along with overperforming and underperforming. Anyway, their confident predictions are so often proven to be painfully wrong that polls are about as useful as horoscopes for dividing the future. That was proven again this election season. I must add that in contrast to the pollsters and their imaginative predictions this season, the various secretaries of state and attorneys general of our many United States have been incredibly impressive in their sincerity and honesty about the careful process of vote counting that is being conducted all around the nation. That is not prediction or spin. It is just straightforward, honest decency about what is taking place now. Perhaps the message is simply that trying to peer beyond the curtain into the mists of the future is best left to God, to weather reporters, and even economists. Our task is not to seek to see what's beyond our vision, you know, around the corner, but to be here, now, and act with decency, honesty, and compassion each and every day. And that should be true for both voters and our elected representatives, for all of us. That's what God wants, and what we should all want, too. To play us in this morning, here's a Yismachu for the Shabbat morning service from Shiri Kidron and Ozzy Schwartz, composed by an old friend, Mayor Finkelstein.
Yismachu v'malchutecha, Yismachu v'malchutecha, Shomrei Shabbat v'korei onek Shabbat. Yismechu v'malchutecha, Yismechu v'malchutecha, Shomrei Shabbat v'korei onek Shabbat. Am mekadshei shevi'i, mekadshei shevi'i Shabbat. Kulam yismehu v'yitangu v'yitangu mitu v'cha Shabbat. Yismechu v'malchutecha, Yismechu v'malchutecha, Shomrei Shabbat v'korei onek Shabbat. Yismechu v'malchutecha, Yismechu v'malchutecha, Shomrei Shabbat v'korei onek Shabbat. Yitamah Nazita poveki da što šabat.
Nazita poveki da što šabat.
Hemetat ja mi moto karata.
Seher le masse.
Seher le masse.
Seher le
Zecher le maaseh bereshit Shabbat. Yismecho v'malechutecha, Yismecho v'malechutecha, Shomrei Shabbat v'kolei onik Shabbat. Yismecho v'malechutecha, Yismecho v'malechutecha, Shomrei Shabbat v'korei onek Shabbat. V'korei onek, v'korei onek,
That was Cantor Shiri Kidron and Ozzy Schwartz singing Yismechu by Cantor Meir Finkelstein. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch J. Kohan, my father, will explore why he has published his new book of Torah commentaries, Learning Torah All Over Again at the Tender Age of 94. Find out when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Congregation Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the entire metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Dinah Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building, not in the mall. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. In these days of coronavirus SARS, a smaller group can join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning wearing masks by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Or you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, and we'll be holding services with full music by virtual experience for the time being, but also in person for masked and socially distant attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom and blended. You can access that by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. A lot of those classes, as well as our wonderful religious school, are available in blended format as well, some live, some on Zoom. Synagogues at 2270 West Dinah Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall. We're not in the mall, but in the south side on our own building. But for now, we are a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook and in small blended formats. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson, for more information. To learn about Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, also taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and the fastest growing synagogue in all of Arizona, and its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, not an unfamiliar character, my father, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, who at the tender age of 94 has published a brand new book, Learning Torah All Over Again, the newest look at the oldest book. Good morning and welcome back to Two Jewish.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
So what prompted you to write this book and why now?
Well, over the years, I used to write blogs on the particular Torah portion of the week, and many of them were published in on the American Rabbi website. I want to appreciate the work of Rabbi David Epstein, and after him, Rabbi Mark Zimmerman, for publishing these blogs. And they seem to acquire some good correspondence. I think Mark Zimmerman is a colleague of yours, right?
Yeah, that's correct, yep. And so you published these blogs over the years, and then at some point decided, you know, I got a book here.
You got it.
What, in putting together this collection, because there's one commentary for every Torah portion of the week.
Right.
You know, kind of like a traditional Torah commentary sequence. did you find that you had some blogs that seemed very current and some that were less so?
That's right. And the goal of this particular book is to take these ancient laws and history and see what applies to our lives today. Because here, you know, we keep on reading Torah year after year. Come to the beginning, the first chapter of Genesis on Simchas Torah. And then by the following Simchas Torah, we're doing the last
Parsha of Devarim, right?
Exactly.
We just finished Deuteronomy, correct?
Yeah. I'm going to start reading it all over again. Well, it's the same Torah, but we are different readers. And so what applies to us today is important.
We will explore learning Torah all over again, much more, with Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, and see how somebody born in 1926 adapts to technology in 2020. When we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email me at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website, twojewishradio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, his very popular Jewish podcast, 100,000 downloads on Podbean, and top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, I think your favorite country in the world really is France, but that may be an overstatement. Still, it's a fascinating place and a fascinating Jewish community that goes back really a long way. Can you give us a little bit of an overview, since we can't all go to Paris right now?
Very happily. And I will say that I was posted to France as a U.S. diplomat twice, actually. I had the good fortune. First posting only lasted about 5 months, and I was direct transferred to Belgrade, always a hazard when you're in the Foreign Service. But the next posting lasted almost 5 years. And the second posting in particular caused me to crisscross France and travel all over it in the pursuit of my professional duties. So I will not be speaking exclusively or even largely about the Jewish community of Paris, but really about the Jewish community of France. However, just before I do that, I want to put in a shameless personal plug,
which Please. Is
your listeners have often indicated to you and to me that they would like more in-depth coverage of the Jewish community of a certain place, be it Thessaloniki or Paris or whatever. So you know that, and many of your listeners know too, that I lead Jewish heritage tours normally overseas. But in this pandemic period, nobody's traveling anywhere, and all my tours were canceled. So I started giving virtual tours in a series of podcasts called Around the Jewish World with Tom Price. And if any of your readers would be interested in podcasts that last between 15 and 20 minutes, they can find it on tomprice.podbean.com.
tomprice.podbean.com.
Right. And Tom Price is one word, all lowercase. Podbean is also one word, all lowercase, and it's P-O-D-B-E-A-N. So, that having been said, let's go back to something I've said many times on your show in reference to countless Jewish communities, which is at the peak of the Roman Empire, when the Mediterranean was accurately referred to as a Roman lake, there were Jewish communities, in some cases very important Jewish communities, in virtually every Mediterranean port city. So whether you were talking about Spain or Morocco or Tunisia or Egypt or Turkey or Greece or what eventually became Italy, the south coast of France, whatever, there were Jews in Roman times in every sizable trading port. And they did a variety of things. Often they were ship's chandlers, suppliers of necessary things, but they also repaired sails, they did craftsmanship, they did all kinds of things. But many of those Jewish communities go back at least 2,000 years. And that is true also in southern France, where actually some of the big cities like Marseille were originally founded by the Greeks, so even older. But when the Greeks controlled much of the Mediterranean, the Jews had not yet spread as widely as they did, because, you know, there was the first diaspora after the destruction of the first temple, obviously.
Right. Yep.
And then there was the second one, which, okay, so the temple was destroyed in the year 70 of the Common Era, but Jews were actually expelled from Jerusalem and the whole Roman province of Judea in the second century of the Common Era.
137 or so.
So basically, right, since then, there have been Jews in all these places. Now, France has a lot of coastal towns on the Mediterranean. In fact, that's one of the most pleasant areas in France. But interestingly, some of the oldest synagogues and oldest cemeteries are found further inland, and we can get into detail about that next week if you'd like.
Thanks, Tom. We will do so.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Benjamin, a young Talmud student who left Israel for America some years earlier, returns to visit his family. Benjamin, where's your beard? Asks his elderly mother, seeing him. Mom, he replies, in America, businessmen don't wear a beard. But at least you keep Shabbos, his mother asks. Mom, business is business. In America, everybody works on Shabbos. But kosher food you still eat? Asks his mother. Ah, Ma, in America, it's so hard to keep kosher. Then silence, while his elderly mother thinks about what she has just heard. Then she leans over and whispers in his ear, Benjamin, tell me, are you still circumcised? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Chayei Sarah, which marks a transition in our Genesis narrative from the tales of Abraham and Sarah, our first Jewish father and mother, towards the next generation, featuring Isaac and Rebekah. But first, we begin with an ending. At the start of the portion, we're told of the length of Sarah's life and almost by accident learn of her death. The life of Sarah was 127 years, the Seder begins. Chaya Sarah is a portion filled with negotiations that will have great influence on the future of the fledgling religion someday to be known as Judaism. The first extended section of Chaya Sarah is actually dedicated to arranging for Sarah's funeral. Abraham purchases the cave of Machpelah in Hebron, the first piece of real estate owned by our people in what will eventually be known as the Land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael. That cave of Machpelah becomes the burial place, not only for Sarah, but for most of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and Leah eventually all find their final resting place in Hebron. In Chaya Sarah, the purchase of this plot involves an extended bargaining session with Ephron the Hittite, who owns it, and the payment of a huge sum for the first permanently Jewish land in the world, establishing Jewish legitimacy in the Middle East at a very early point in history. I visited Machpelah a few times, once many years ago when you could go into the cave itself, and then a few years ago when Jews were only permitted by the Israeli authorities to go into the area above the cave itself for fear of creating a violent incident. Nonetheless, it's a powerful place. After the burial in Hebron, the narrative moves us forward with one last important detailed episode of Abraham's life. Abraham is old. He sees that his son Isaac is not yet married, and perhaps seems unlikely to do so without parental intervention. Abraham charges his trusted servant to return to the old country of Sumeria, Haran, in eastern Turkey, just north of today's Syria, and bring back a suitable girl for Isaac to marry and carry on the line of believers in the one true God. After a long journey and the first extended prayer included in the Torah, the servant meets Rebekah drawing water from the city well in Haran. He knows that she is the one for Isaac because she shows generosity and intelligence. The servant, too, bargains, in this case, Rebekah's duplicitous brother and father. Eventually, the servant arranges for her to become Isaac's wife, but at the crucial moment of the narrative, Rebekah's family puts the question to her, "Will you go with this man?" That is, will she leave all she has known and journey to an unknown land and future husband? This final negotiation in Chaya Sarah is brief. Rebekah quickly agrees, yes. She will leave the homeland and her father's house and go to the land that will be shown to her. Like Abraham before her, she embraces this call to begin a new life. And so Rebekah goes and meets Isaac, and the future of the people and of monotheism is assured. These three negotiations revolve around crucial elements in our people's history: land, descendants, and destiny. Without title to the land of Israel, we would have remained homeless wanderers. Without descendants, we would have ceased to be. And without the courageous choice of women and men, like Rebekah and Abraham before her, our destiny would have been disappearance. As Jews, these remain our principal goals today, and often they still require negotiation to achieve: a secure land of Israel, our children and grandchildren's Judaism, and the destiny of our people as a moral light to the nations. They are great goals, and we must continue to work to try to achieve them. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Baruch Kohan, my father, and the author of a newly published book of Torah commentaries, Learning Torah All Over Again, explores how he looks at this greatest of all Jewish texts. Find out when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A radicalized Muslim man opened fire in an area of Vienna with several synagogues, killing 4 people and injuring 22. While this occurred in close range of a prominent Vienna rabbi, the attack did not specifically involve Jewish institutions, said the president of the city's communal organization. Oscar Deutsch, president of the Jewish community in Vienna, said that none of the city's Jewish institutions appear to have been hit, nor were any of the wounded or killed Jewish. But he did not know if they had been a target in the shooting nonetheless, and warned the city's Jews, that is the Jews of Vienna, to stay home. One police officer was shot and remains in critical condition. The Austrian Ministry of the Interior said the incident was a terrorist attack. One of the perpetrators, a 20-year-old with Austrian and North Macedonian citizenship, is said to have shouted Allah before being killed at the scene, said the Interior Minister Karl Niehammer. The shooting happened on the Schwedenplatz, a square located opposite the Carmelite Quarter, where several synagogues are located. Rabbi Shlomo Hofmeister lives in the compound of the synagogue. Upon hearing shots, we looked down from the windows and saw a gunman shooting at the guests of the various bars and pubs with a long gun, he said. Gunmen were running around and shooting at least 100 rounds or more in front of our building. Shots were also fired in the Vienna Stadtpark, a main park in the city. The Muslim terrorist shootings took place on the warm final night before a countrywide COVID-19 lockdown was implemented. These shootings shocked the Viennese. Vienna, unlike Paris, London, Berlin, Madrid, or Rome, is not so used to Islamist terrorist attacks in recent years. Way back in 1981, two people were killed and 18 injured during an attack by two Palestinians at the Vienna synagogue, in front of which this incident took place. In 1985, also a long time ago, a Palestinian terrorist group killed three civilians in an attack at the local airport. That was it until this past August, when authorities arrested a 31-year-old Syrian refugee suspected of trying to attack a Jewish community leader in Graz, Austria's second-largest city. That leader was unhurt. This violence came as quite a terrible shock to the Viennese. According to Niehammer, this shooter tried to join the Islamic State in 2019 and was sentenced to 22 months in prison, but was released early. There was an early release of a radicalized man, said Niehammer. Remains unclear if the shooter was attempting to attack one or more of the synagogues in the area. Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz said that while it was clearly a very professionally planned terrorist attack, it's still not clear the motivation was anti-Semitic. Austrian police will continue to search for possible accomplices of the dead 20-year-old terrorist. Authorities say he was part of a possible synchronized terrorist attack at six locales in downtown Vienna, only some of which came off. A Jewish cemetery in Michigan was graffitied with the words Trump and MAGA last week. The graffiti vandalism occurred 3 days before the presidential election, in which Michigan was a key swing state, just before President Donald Trump's final campaign rally in the Grand Rapids area. The 100-year-old cemetery in the western Michigan city of Grand Rapids belongs to Congregation Ahavas Yisrael, a conservative synagogue. Rabbi David Krischeff said the vandalism is presumed to have occurred over the weekend. Police were contacted about it, but both he and the ADL's local director said it was too soon to call this vandalism an act of anti-Semitism. According to photos posted to Twitter by the ADL's office in Michigan, several gravestones were tagged with red paint reading Trump and MAGA. The vandalism occurred just days before Election Day in a swing state that both the Trump and Biden campaigns fought hard for. It looks like Biden has won Michigan. It also occurred roughly 1 year after the city's Reform Synagogue, Temple Emmanuel, was vandalized with neo-Nazi posters by a hate group, including one that read, "A crusade against Semite-led subhumans." And Jewish voters favored Joe Biden over President Donald Trump 77% to 20% in an exit poll of 800 voters around the country, if you believe polls these days, which I don't. Anyway, that is consistent with expectations before the election, which showed Biden with a margin of 75% to 22% among Jewish voters. American Jews have consistently voted for Democratic presidential candidates by fairly similar margins ever since 1984. Continuing this trend of some 36 years duration. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan. In addition to being my father, he is a distinguished cantor and rabbi who has served in many important offices over the course of his 94 years. His new book is called Learning Torah All Over Again, an exploration of each Torah portion. It's accessible. It's sequential. And in putting this together, I have to say there are some Torah portions that jump out, and as Rashi says about Genesis 1, that say, you know, drash me, teach me. Mm-hmm. Others maybe a little bit less so. Do you have favorite interpretations in this text?
I like them all. I really do.
By the book, he likes them all.
That's why I put them in there. I like them all.
So when you come to something like Tazria Metzorah, for example, in Leviticus, you know, the famous Torah portions about leprosy, for example, a little less appetizing than some others. How do you approach something like that?
Well, there are contaminations. You know, tumah in Hebrew is really contamination.
Contamination and purification.
There are contaminations, right, that we make to ourselves of various kinds, which we can learn from the Torah what to do about it.
So, in a way, that there are contemporary problems we create for ourselves. This week we're doing Torah portion of Chayei Sarah. You mentioned you had a couple of insights about that to share.
Well, you know, you and I share a good melody together. Eilu devorim shein lohem shiur, apeyo v'yabikurim v'yorayim. And that is typical of our traditional attitude towards Torah readings, that some things have no measure. And the Torah lists the Mishnah lists some of these things: honoring parents, doing kindness, visiting the sick, bringing home the bride, burying the dead, and making peace between neighbors. These have no measure. You know, you do it as much as you can, and rated equal to all the sum of all these immeasurable qualities is learning Torah, because that's where our principles come from.
So in learning Torah, which you began, that all came out of books, I suspect that most adults that are learning Torah, studying Torah today, do most of their learning online. You know, they search things, they find a word, they look up another word, it leads to another thing. In a funny way, that's very similar to using like a Mikrot Gedolot, a great compendium of Torah commentaries that our people has always used. You'd read the text, you look down at Rashi, then you go and see what Ibn Ezra says or what Rashbam says about what Rashi says, and maybe you look at the Targum, see what Onkelos has in Aramaic, and you bounce around to all the different commentaries. In creating your own Torah commentary, who are your favorite Torah commentators that you like to consult?
Well, of course, Rashi is the classic, you know. You can't beat Rashi. You figure the Torah is perhaps the oldest book as contained its identical content over many, many centuries.
Yeah, at least 2,000 years, and we can see from the Dead Sea Scrolls, same text, right?
Right. The cover of my book says, this is the newest look at the oldest book, because here we take a new look at it every year. I think we're talking about this week's Torah reading,
portion, right?
Yeah. Has several elements in it that we might use as examples. Here, the name of the Sedra is Chayei Sarah, the life of Sarah. What does it start with? Her death.
Yeah.
But it doesn't talk about her death, it talks about her life.
Yeah, she never actually dies, right? I mean, we don't see her death, we just find out she's dead.
Yeah, that's right. And lists her age because it says she was 100 years old and 20 years old and 7 years old. It doesn't say a total of 127 years. And of course, the classic explanation of that is that she was as beautiful at the age of 100 as she was at 20, and as innocent at the age of 20 as she was at 7. So this is the mother of our people. So there are several elements in this sedra that we can think about in terms of where we are now. One is how her husband, Abraham, having lost his wife, wants to find a burial place for her, and he goes and bargains with the owners, the Hittites, who own this territory. And he's an expert bargainer. After all, we saw him bargain with God for the Sodom.
For Sodom and Gomorrah, right?
Right. And so there is that element of it, which, of course, has to do with our lives today. We don't always pay the listed price.
I don't think you've ever paid the listed price. Isn't that the great Jewish sin to pay retail?
Something like that. Actually, what he does in this particular episode is that after talking with the Hittites, the owner, the Hittite owner of the Machpelah, says, this is, he just casually says, what is a 400 shekel tract of land between you and me? So Abraham has good ears. He hears what the man said. He doesn't say a word. He just hands him 400 shekels.
Right. It's a great lesson. And actually, negotiating continues to work that way today, doesn't it?
Yeah. But I think perhaps the most important lesson that we can learn from this whole sedra has to do with the son. Her son is Isaac, of course, and they want a bride for him. And so Abraham sends his servant Eliezer to the Haran, where the clan lives, Abraham's family, and he finds Rebekah, who is, you know, is a beautiful virgin, and she invites him to their house, and he comes in and they negotiates with Lavan, her brother, who is not the savory kind of character. But what happens is they eventually say, shall we send her back with him to be his wife? And her father says, call the girl in or we'll ask her, which sets a standard for a marriage from a period of history when arranged marriages were common.
Yeah, women were just chattel, really.
And they were sold. You know, sold, yeah. To marry off somebody for business reasons, right?
Right.
But a Jewish girl cannot be married without her consent.
Right.
And from that day on to now, it happens.
Yeah, it reminds me of Fiddler on the Roof, right? You
know? Exactly, yes.
It's consistent. In looking at the way that we, how do you see the difference in the way that we look at Torah today over how it was, how you were taught originally growing up? Are there changes in the way that we understand, we interpret text?
Probably. We change. So our approach to learning changes too. I didn't look out for that in writing this book.
Right.
But I'm sure you have a good point there. How would you characterize it?
I guess I would think that there are certain, you know, we have access to so much information instantaneously. You know, your father, my grandfather, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen, of blessed memory, was considered, you know, kind of a genius. He knew an Elui. He knew all of the commentaries and all of the texts, and he could collate all of that stuff, and he created a concordance, but Makorot HaYahadut, like sources of on Judaism. And you needed to be kind of a tremendous scholar to have that wealth of information at your fingertips. You could just say, yeah, of course, that's just like this, or this commentary. The Kli Yakar said this. that's no longer necessary in a funny way. Almost everybody has access through the internet to an enormous amount of information. You can look up any term instantaneously. You don't need a library. The library is there online for you. But you have to have some way of discerning what's real and what's not useful and pulling all that together. And I think the skills are less about having a tremendous base of knowledge and then being able to apply it, as they are understanding what you're looking at and making distinctions. And maybe that's not so different, but you used to really have to access all those texts, know all those languages. Now there's so much more you can just, I can just Google that.
Well, that's true. It's easier to find it. One other element that you didn't mention, but I'm sure you're aware of it because you use it yourself, is that we have now available to us scientific information that applies to the subjects that discussed in the Torah that we didn't have in past generations. Sometimes it supports Torah principles, and sometimes it conflicts with Torah principles. But we sometimes need to consider that also.
Right, right. I mean, you know, it's funny when I think that people felt like they were living in such a modern age 140 or 50 years ago. Things have changed so much and so fast. It's fascinating that we can still look at a text, the Torah, which is created literally thousands of years ago, and find contemporary meaning. In putting this book together, what surprised you the most about the process? Putting learning Torah together, learning Torah all over again, what surprised you the most in putting together your book?
Probably the fact that some Jewish publisher said they didn't need it.
Some Jewish publishers don't publish a lot of books anymore, too. What's the virtue of a book as opposed to just scanning and looking up stuff online? What do you like about books still? Because I know you do both. I mean, you look at stuff online all the time.
Yes, but, what's online stays there, and usually you don't have it available. Like a book is something solid. You can hold it in your hand and look at the pages.
Do you prefer to look stuff up in a book still?
Yes.
I share that bias, although I do look out stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. There's something just like reading in the Torah, right? The scroll of Torah hasn't changed in a long time. It's still handwritten by a scribe on parchment. It's been around since the time of the Second Temple. It'll be around for a long time to come.
Yeah, right.
When you created your blogs originally, did you intend them to be in a book?
No, I didn't have that in mind then. But as you said before, it dawned on me after a while that here I have the material.
You got a book
it's
there.
It's all there.
Yeah. How many commentaries do you tend to consult before you write a sermon or write a drash?
Good question. I've never counted them. Two or three for sure. Rashi and Pli Yochor. Basically what are printed in the Chumash that I use.
Right.
Whatever
commentaries are handy,
those are available, they're right there.
The book is called Learning Torah All Over Again by Baruch Kohan. Where can people go to find it?
Amazon.
The source for everything.
Of course.
Yes. Might have started with books and other stuff, but boy, could you get everything there. Dad, thank you very much. Any closing thoughts about creating this book, Learning Torah All Over Again?
I'm looking forward to distributing it at your congregation.
Right.
And
God willing, we can reassemble and hold public events.
Some of your members have it, I think, but
they do indeed.
People, if they want, can buy it from me directly.
That's right.
I have a limited number of copies, but I have few.
Okay. That I can sell. So you can find a way to get it to you. Dad, thanks very much.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Congregation Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the entire metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Dinah Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building, not in the mall. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. In these days of coronavirus sorus, a smaller group can join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning wearing masks by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Or you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, and we'll be holding services with full music by virtual experience for the time being, but also in person for masked and socially distant attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom and blended. You can access that by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. A lot of those classes, as well as our wonderful religious school, are available in blended format as well, some live, some on Zoom. Synagogues at 2270 West Dinah Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall. We're not in the mall, but in the south side on our own building. But for now, we are a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook and in small blended formats. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, Beitsimcha Tucson, for more information. To learn about Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, also taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services on Facebook, go to beitsimchatucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and the fastest growing synagogue in all of Arizona and its exciting beginning years. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning also comes from Shiri Kidron, one of the most beautiful songs that came out of the Vilna Ghetto, Unter dein weißer Stern, Under Your White Stars, written by poet Avraham Sutzkever, set to music by Avram Brudno. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be renowned feminist author, psychologist, and activist Phyllis Chesler, discussing her startling new book, a deeply insightful exploration of the strange mind of Eileen Wormos, called Requiem for a Female Serial Killer. My friends, may you have a Shavuot Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and, God willing, of peace.
Unter deine weiße Sternen streckt zu mir dein weiße Hand. Meine Wärter seinen Tränen will in ruhen in dein Hand. Seh es dunkelt sehr Finkel in mein Kehler dicken Blick.
Blick. Und ich hab gar nicht kein Winkel, sie zu schenken dir zurück. Und ich hab gar nicht kein Winkel, sie zu schenken dir zurück. Und ich will doch Gott getreuen, dir vertreuen mein Vermeck. Weil es mordet mir auf Feuer und in Feuer.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.